institutions that deal with water issues. And we're all in the West here. We're on pretty much a first name basis with the folks that work in these institutions, and give you a sense of how that interacts with state law. And we'll just see how much time I have. I might get into compacts later, but I'm not too sure we're going to have the time. So we'll just see how this goes. Before I start, let's see. I want to make sure. I think we're still missing a couple of students, Allie. Is that true?
Yeah, you have three in here right now. Okay. Missing.
Well, we're going to go ahead and go since everybody's online. So let me share my screen. Now, I am, usually I watch the chat line, and I'm going to try to do that as we go along. I have several breaks where we can have questions, and I want the students to ask their questions first, if they have any, and then we'll see if other folks have some, and we'll go from there. So bear with me as I'm doing this and also trying to keep track of your questions on chat. And let me share my screen. There. Everybody see that? I see some nods, so we'll go with a yes. Okay. So, bring this back up. Okay. So, as I said, we're going to talk about federal water law and institutions. And one thing I want to remind the class about is that you do have papers due right before Thanksgiving or right after Thanksgiving for the class, and that's 40% of your grade. And it's taking a water issue and looking at it from the law, the policy, and development implementation, and then also maybe looking at the politics as this law and was forming and policies were being formed. So a reminder to those students. So this of course is the capital of the United States, and we're going to move on to a slide that's not there. All right. I don't know what happened to that slide. Well, the first slide was an introduction slide, and we'll be hitting these individually, but there are several national water laws that you need to be aware of, and you probably already are. We have, what's interesting is we really had no kind of protection until the 70s. And at late 60s, early 70s, into the 80s, the public started having an interest in protecting the environment more. We saw that we've done a lot of developing. We built a lot of reservoirs. We've built a lot of industry. But we saw that the environment around us was declining. And so that became a public discussion that led to several laws. The first federal law was the National Environmental Protection Act of 1970. And this act was set up to essentially protect the environment as a whole. So any project you did or anything that happened, you interacted with the federal government, you had to look and see how the environment was affected. If you were building a reservoir or if you were even if you were just borrowing money from the federal government, you had to look at that. After that came the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Those we'll be talking, the Clean Water Act, I'm going to talk a little bit in depth, and we'll hear more from the gal from CDPHE who will be talking to you next week. The these laws, again, were focused on protecting our healthy rivers and also protecting drinking water, essentially. But as you know, in this case, of like Flint, we're still struggling with that to a degree. Another act was the Endangered Species Act, which protects endangered and threatened species. And it often affects water, water structures, because if you're hurting an endangered species in the river, you may not be able to divert all the water that you usually can divert. And so we have a lot of interaction with endangered species. Also, if we have time, and if not, we'll kick this to another lecture. We have 9 compacts and 2 decrees, interstate, 2 Supreme Court decrees that rule our rivers in Colorado. Compacts are federal law and they're state law. They're agreements among the states, but they have to be approved by the state legislatures and also by Congress. So that's another mix of federal and state law. State law has to meet the requirements of the compact. And in order to do that, the state engineer has the authority to shut water diverters down if we're not meeting our compact delivery requirements. Like I said, we'll talk about that a little bit more. I apologize. I had a nice pretty slide, but I don't know where it is. So the first thing I want to talk about is the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine. And this was established by the Supreme Court in 1908. Here it was decided that when the Congress set aside land for an Indian tribe, it was intended that they would also get water. And what happened with respect to this is that the state folks started adjudicating water rights, the state water rights, and they were ignoring the needs of the tribe. And so the tribe sued, and it was decided that they too can get water rights. The interesting part of their water rights is that their adjudication date, and remember the adjudication date is what's very important with a water right. The adjudication date is the date that the tribal reservation was established. So almost all tribes pretty much have senior water rights if they've adjudicated their rights. Now we're going to have John Echohawk, who's from the Native American Rights Fund, and he's going to talk quite a bit. He's going to spend an hour talking about tribal reserve water rights. So that'll be very interesting here in November. Then in 1963, the Supreme Court, much to the surprise of quite a few people, said that the reserved rights doctrine also applies to public lands that have been set aside by the government. And so that includes forests, BLM land. In fact, here is a map of all the different federal lands and Indian reservations we have. And you can see most of the activity is here in the West. The red is the Indian reservations. The yellow is BLM land. You can see Nevada and Utah are very heavily laid in with BLM land. Light green is Forest Service, a lot here in Colorado. And kind of that mid green is the national parks. If you want to pick out a national park, there's Yellowstone right there. So this is land that has been officially set aside by the government. And under the Supreme Court decision in Arizona v. California, all of that land also comes with water rights that can have to, that should be adjudicated and that have a priority date of when they were set aside by Congress or by the executive. So integrating these Federal Reserve water rights into state water rights has been a challenge on many different levels. Usually, here in Colorado, we have a constantly adjudicating water court system. So it was a little easier to a degree. So you're always going to water court. In other states, they started formal adjudications of their water rights. And then the tribes or the federal government would file claims, or they would just file suit in federal district court and work through what water they're deserved. Now, the standard for the water right is whatever is needed to preserve the purpose of the reservation. With Indian tribes, John will talk about this, it used to be what they called, it used to be arable, practically arable land. Now, that's been, the Arizona Supreme Court has broadened that a little bit and talks about a homeland reservation and what a tribe needs for the homeland. So that's still developing law. So I've worked for the Department of Interior for over 10 years, and these are the agencies you deal most with respect to water issues. So we have the Bureau of Reclamation, the Fish and Wildlife Service, USGS, and the Bureau of Land Management. Each of these agencies are responsible for different pieces of the laws that we're going to talk about. Other agencies are the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. We have Commerce has NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Agency. They kind of changed their name, and I think that's still right. So, and then the Forest Service also. So, with that, let's start with the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act of 1968. This act preserved the rivers with outstanding natural, cultural, and recreational values in the free-flowing conditions as designated by Congress. So this was at the beginning of that environmental awareness. And this was wanting to protect these rivers that dams kept being built on, and people felt that we needed to keep them in their natural conditions. So it provided protection against bank and channel alterations. It does create a Federal Reserve water right. And right now there are about 13,000 miles of rivers in 40 states that are wild and scenic. Colorado has just one wild and scenic river, and that is the Cache Lapeuder. That there are 76 miles that were designated in 1986. I wanted to put a map up, but the map is kind of a crazy map and it just wouldn't translate well. So if you're curious about the Lapeuder Wild and Scenic, go ahead and Google it and look it up. It's very interesting. There have been other attempts to establish wild and scenic rivers in Colorado. Those have failed, but not because people didn't want them. It was trying to figure out, you get groups of people trying to figure out how they could protect the river, but how we could also protect development. And so there have been a lot of compromises that have come up, especially on the West Slope. One intermix in particular is when Salazar was senator, and he was the Interior Secretary for Obama for a while, but before that he was a senator for Colorado. And he worked hard with BLM to establish protection of an in-stream flow in the Dominguez Canyon on the West Slope. Now, remember I said that if it has a water right, if it's been if the government has said, has reserved the land. Well, because it's a water right for a wild and scenic river, that means that water right is pretty much the whole river. And depending on where that's located, that could affect future development plans. But what Senator Salazar did was one of the most interesting things and ways to approach this. He insisted that BLM work first through the Colorado In-Stream Flow Program to establish that in-stream flow, and then that would be used as the Federal Reserve water right. So that was a very unique way to handle something that could have been really contentious. I'm going to stop right there and just see if we have any other questions or thoughts or concerns. And I can't see all of you, so there you are, Johanna. Anybody have any questions? Anybody else have questions? Okay, hearing none, and I'm gonna move on. The next environmental act was the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, of 1970. And as I said before, federal agencies had to give consideration to the environment prior to undertaking any major federal action. A major federal action could be anywhere from building an infrastructure to lending or granting federal dollars. Under the Environmental Protection Act, the federal agency prepares an environmental impact statement, which is shortened to EIS, or an environmental assessment. It's common. One of the interesting things about this, so everything like the NIST project that you hear about or you heard about from Brad, wind, any other projects that deal with being on the water or near the water or affecting the water have to go through this process. When I was in the Attorney General's office in the 90s, in the early 2000s, the general rule of thumb was it took 10 years and $10 million to get an EIS. I'm here to tell you that's not the case anymore. It costs a lot more. And I know that Brad Wynn wanted to talk about that a little bit, and I cut him off. But you can read that information on Northern's website if you want. So it takes time. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of public process to make sure people are participating and you're understanding the impacts and they're understanding the analysis. And it goes on for a very, very long time. The next environmental act to come up was the Clean Water Act of 1972. And this was a pollution, this is run by the Environmental Protection Agency. This was a pollution control program for waters of the United States. So EPA developed national water quality criteria for recommendations for pollutants in surface water or in navigable water or waters of the United States. The act requires that before there are any point source discharges into waters of the United States, you must get an NPDES permit. That's a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. Also, if any dredged or fill material is going to be discharged into waters of the United States, you need a 404 permit. The So the states and tribes can assume responsibility of the program, and they can require stricter standards than what the federal government may require. Colorado does have responsibility for 401 permitting, and you'll hear a little bit more of that from Nicole. In 1992, the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, decided that the Clean Water Act also applies between two states. So this is a case where Arkansas was the lower state, part of the river, and Oklahoma, the upper. And Oklahoma's was putting water into the a shared river that met Oklahoma's standards, water quality standards. But it did not meet Arkansas's water quality standards. And so this led to Arkansas v. Oklahoma, and the Supreme Court said that an upper state has to comply with the lower state's water quality parameters. Then another important note, I think, for the Clean Water Act is 404 permit exemptions. Again, this is for dredge and fill. Farming activities, ranching, forestry activities are all exempt with respect to discharge into waters of the United States. That tends to be controversial sometimes. And it's always interesting, as to how to approach this. So every once in a while in Congress, you'll see somebody take a run at removing these exemptions, but they've stayed and probably will stay. I'm gonna stop with that. And this picture, by the way, is the Gold King mine spill that happened in 2016. This happened in Colorado. As it turned out, EPA caused the spill. They were working on a closed mine, and it spread a lot of pollution over three states and a couple of Indian tribes. There's still litigation going on with respect to this, but it's working through the system. Let me stop there with Clean Water Act and see if there's any questions.
Hey, Jennifer, there's also some questions in the chat, just FYI.
Okay. Do you want to read them to me, Allie?
Sure. Okay. Rio asked, are the water rights associated with wild and scenic rivers exclusively in-stream flow rights?
Rio, well, that's a great question. The water rights are in-stream flow. But the act also affects and protects the banks. So it would protect any construction activity or any disturbance activity along the banks. Go ahead, Allie.
All right. And then Megan just had a comment, and she said that the lower 45 miles of the Poudre is a national heritage area.
Yes, that's correct. So there, besides the Wild and Scenic Act, we have several national heritage protective areas. And thank you very much for mentioning that. And I think it's probably even on that map I showed. Anything else?
That's it from the chat.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
So for the mine spill that you were just talking about, who is holding the EPA accountable for that? Or like who is bringing up
The state of New Mexico is suing EPA. The state of Utah is suing EPA. And the Navajo Nation, I believe, is also suing EPA. There might be a Pueblo in there that's suing EPA. And so they're looking for damages because the drinking water was damaged. The riparian areas were damaged. And that's how it's being accountable. I mean, EPA acknowledged that it blew it. But now somebody has to pay for it, and it may probably be the taxpayers of the United States along the way. Anything else? Okay, good questions. Thank you. And Allie, just interrupt me because I can't see the chat box when I'm on sharing my screen.
You got it. I'll let you know.
Thank you. So here's where I'm going to bring one of our class members in, and that's Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for building dams and regulating flows of navigable waters. They have a lot of flood control projects, and they are primarily responsible for issuing 404 permits. States can also apply to issue those permits, but I think only two have that ability. So it's pretty much the Corps of Engineers. And the picture here is a picture of Chatfield Dam. And dam is a flood regulating reservoir. The interesting thing that's happened in the last 10 years with this dam is that as we've struggled with water supply in Colorado, we've been looking at all of our reservoirs and saying, is there a way to increase the amount of water we put in these reservoirs, and how could that be done under operations? And so the state of Colorado worked well with the Corps of Engineers and figured out how to reoperate the reservoir so that we could store more water in the reservoir. And I can't exactly remember how much that is, but it was a significant amount. And so we see that partnership with the Army Corps has been very helpful. Mattia, you work for the Corps. You want to talk about it a little bit?
Sure. So I work for the Modeling, Mapping, and Consequences Center within the Corps, and we're primarily focused on risk of our projects. And so every 5 years, each of our dams is inspected. And so the Modeling, Mapping, and Consequences Center comes in, and we do assessments on that dam. And so downstream communities can do things like prepare evacuation plans, or they can see kind of what infrastructure might be destroyed. And districts within the Corps can make plans to kind of fortify places where it could be unsafe. And then we do this for our dams and levees. And anytime there's emergency operations, such as hurricanes or big storms that get stalled, we help FEMA with flood inundation mapping so that they can evacuate people within city limits.
Do you concentrate on a particular area in the United States?
So most districts do, but the MMC is national support. So any district, any state can request that the MMC come in and help out.
Well, that's a wonderful job to have. You have to feel pretty righteous that you're helping people, huh?
I do sometimes. Other times it's kind of stressful.
Well, I mean, there's always arguments about those floodplain designations and who's affected and the science involved to determine that. But I think it's a very interesting place to work. Thank you so much for hopping in here.
You're welcome.
Any other thoughts or questions?
We just had a comment from the chat from Tony. He said he's from Yavapai County. I'm so sorry if I said that wrong. In Arizona, and he just wanted to say thank you for opening this up to a wider audience.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Welcome. We're having a lot of fun with this, and we appreciate all the support we got. And Rio, I keep seeing your pictures, so I'm glad you're here. I brag that the San Luis Valley is on board. So one of the newsworthy items with respect to the Clean Water Act is defining waters of the United States. And it has been a difficult journey over the last 12, 14 years to determine what you call waters of the United States. Under the Act, it talks about traditional navigable waters, it talks about interstate waters, and it talks about any other waters that could affect interstate or foreign commerce, impoundments of waters of the U.S., tributaries, territorial seas, and adjacent wetlands. So the picture here I have here is of the Arapaho National Wildlife Refuge at North Park. And as you can see, there are a lot of wetlands attached to that river. And that's an obvious waters of the United States. But that is almost too simplistic. I have given this talk on waters of the United States now. This is my fourth time for this class. And I've had to change the slide every time because things have developed over the course of time. Originally, waters of the United States was defined by the Supreme Court in a case called Rapanos versus the United States, 2006. This was what we call a 4-1-4 opinion. So that means there were four of the majority, there were four that dissented, and that there one was, okay, I agree with the guys that have the opinion, but I got there in a different way. And that was Justice Kennedy. So basically, the court said that WOTUS includes relatively permanent standing or continuously flowing bodies of water. Justice Kennedy then articulated a significant nexus test. If there is a significant nexus, and I'm looking for the quote, a body of water is waters of the United States if it significantly affects chemical, physical, and biological integrity of other navigable waters. So that was the significant nexus test. Now, when you have this kind of split decision by the court, it's pretty open to interpretation as to what will or will not be considered a waters of the United States. And consequently, the EPA and the Corps developed guidance about 2007-2008, and they used the significant nexus test as that guidance, and they explained how that would work and what it would work for. Well, that wasn't good enough for many people, and so Obama came in, and the Obama rule broadened the scope of waters of the United States. So it brought that to the degree that unconnected waters like prairie potholes would be considered waters of the United States. So they could be unconnected to navigable waters, but if they're ecologically important, i.e. if a bird lands there and then goes to waters of the United States spreading pollen, then that might be considered a waters of the United States. That too was very controversial. Many states filed lawsuits with respect to the Obama rule. Trump then, before any lawsuits were resolved, Trump came in with his people and they established another rule, which is considerably narrowed the scope and narrowed it basically to adjacent wetlands. So this is a very convoluted and difficult analysis that you go through, but it's very important because if you're discharging waters into these states, into the United States, waters of the United States, you have to get permits. And so what you need to know what's included in that definition. The American Fisheries Society put out this little cartoon that I thought did a good job of kind of looking at what was the issue with waters of the United States. If you see off to the left, you have a wetland outside of the floodplain that may have been covered under the Obama rule and is no longer covered under the Trump rule. If the wetland's inside the floodplain, essentially, it is covered. If it's an ephemeral stream, it's not protected under the Trump rule, where it could have been protected under the Obama rule. And then the other question that came up were intermittent streams. And what the Trump rule decided to do is include those intermittent streams if they're continually, if they have a continuous, how do I want to say it? If there's evidence of periodic but consistent surface water flow to other waters of the United States. Groundwater is not included and is not defined under as a water of the United States at this time. There was a question about that under the Obama rule, but that's where we've landed. So we've landed with the Trump rule, which is being litigated. And I have a bit of a cartoon to show you to help look at this. So if we look at these circles or ovals, the 2008 rules were established, guidance were established after Rapanos looking at the significant nexus. 2015 rule under the Obama administration broadened that scope significantly. In comes the Trump administration, and then they've reduced that the scope significantly. And from my point of view, this is how I feel sometimes when I talk about WOTUS. So that's a complicated area. I'm going to stop there and see if there are any comments or questions with respect to it.
Yeah, we have a question from Dick in the chat. He said, how would the St. Lawrence Seaway fit into this definition of U.S. waters? It controls navigation and commerce into the Great Lakes.
And it is international waters like that. It is part of waters of the United States, but I'm not as familiar on how they deal specifically with the international aspect of it. So I apologize, but I don't know the answer to that question. Any other questions or thoughts or comments? Okay, good. This slide makes me dizzy, so I need to get off of it. So next step on the environmental slate was the Endangered Species Act of 1973. This act is a program to conserve and protect threatened and endangered species in their habitats. It requires federal agencies to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service regarding any actions they authorize, fund, or carry out. The pictures here are the hooping crane and the least sturgeon, which are endangered species on the Platte River. We also have the piping plover and the Preble's jumping mouse, also endangered species in the Platte River Basin. So when these projects move forward, the Fish and Wildlife Service is the agency that does an analysis to look at whether these threatened species are affected. So if the reclamation had a project that it was going to do, it would first on its own do a biological assessment and look at whether or not it affects these species, and if it does affect them, how it can mitigate that. Then it hands that to the Fish and Wildlife Service, who issues a biological opinion. And that opinion may agree with what reclamation said, may disagree, may require more conditions to preserve the endangered species. We have here on the Platte River, is protected by the Platte River Biological Opinion that has set out conditions for these four endangered species that I've put up here, as well as others. And we have a really well working system with the three states, Wyoming, Nebraska, and Colorado, and the federal government, where we are pursuing projects that make sure the water is there for those endangered species, and working together to protect them. Julie, are you on? Do you want to say anything about the Platte River Recovery Program at all?
I don't believe Julie is on this one.
That's okay.
Oh, wait. Is she there? Sorry, I'm trying to look.
I think she's been in and out from what I've seen.
Oh, okay.
Moving on, looking at a couple of the bigger organizations, the Bureau of Reclamation was established in 1902. Its mission was to reclaim the West. It built dams, reservoirs, irrigation canals, also hydropower. It's the second largest producer of hydropower in the West. There's Hoover Dam, is probably one of the most famous dams, especially with respect to Colorado River. You see that in the right or the left-hand corner. And down on the bottom is Grand Coulee, another large dam up on the Columbia River. Now these irrigation districts, or I'm sorry, the projects that had been established by Reclamation pretty much helped to build up the West and the economy, national economy in the West. There's many books out there that talk about individual projects, but there's also books that just talk about overall whether, how we peopled the West and how reclamation projects helped us do that. Reclamation projects are funded by something called the Reclamation Fund that had initial money put in by Congress, and then districts, irrigation districts, conservation districts would borrow that money for these projects and then pay it back over time. So that's still a fund that is in our system, and we'll have to see what happens with it. It's considered, we're not sure exactly how much money is in that fund and where it goes. So that could take up a whole nother lecture, and I'll stop at that. Here are reclamation reservoirs in Colorado. As you can see, there are quite a few. Horsetooth, Flatiron, Carter Lake on this side of the divide. And then you have the Blue Mesa Reservoir system on the east side. The Colorado Big Thompson Project, Brad Wynn talked about, I just wanted to remind you, was one of the major projects, first major projects by Reclamation in Colorado. And its purpose was to bring Colorado River water over the divide for the Eastern Plains cities and farmers. I'm not gonna go into it any more than that because Brad spent some time on that. Another important agency for water users is the USGS. This is a snapshot of their gauging stations in all rivers in Colorado, and there's a lot of them. And you can go on their website, and you can go to their maps, and you can click on any one of those and find out what water is flowing and learn about, usually it'll tell you the temperature and things like that. So USGS has these kind of gauges all over the United States. And that's a very important part because you have to be able to measure water in order to divide it. So if you want your senior water right and you're a junior, you wanna make sure the senior's only taking what what he or she's allowed. And then you're only allowed to take what's allowed. So knowing what's in the stream is very important, and you get that hour-to-hour information from USGS. And also USGS has a couple of satellites, Landsat 8. This is an example of the annual evapotranspiration for the Colorado River Basin, taken from Landsat 8. That's all pretty technical, and that's about all I know. So I'm going to stop there. And I just want to see if there are any other questions or thoughts. And we'll save the compacts for later. Natalie, do you have anything? Nope.
I have a question.
Sure, Mattia.
So does the Bureau of Reclamation still receive regular government funding, or are they just sustained off of that fund?
No, they do receive funding because they've expanded after the building issue was there, but now they do the hydropower. They have grants for how to manage water. They have to deal with endangered species. So all of that is, they do have a fund, and I used to know what their budget was, but I can't remember right off the bat.
Okay.
It's not as much as the Corps, I can tell you that. Johanna, do you have any thoughts or questions?
No, everything was answered.
Okay. I'll open it up then to anyone else. I know this was a blast, a fast blast through things, but I wanted to, there are laws that are important to cover. And so I wanted to make sure we got through that. Is there anyone else online that would like to ask a question? Allie, do we have any questions in the chat box?
Nothing new, no.
Okay.
Jennifer, it's Rio.
Hi, Rio.
Hi. Thanks for your comment before. hey, I was wondering, are you aware of any other projects like the Closed Basin Project in the San Luis Valley that, you know, the Bureau of Rec put together, that they pump groundwater and deliver it into the river to help meet the compact, and supposed to draw down or salvage water from killing the surface vegetation? And hasn't really proved out, but are there any other groundwater projects like that?
You know, the Coast Water Basin Project was a disappointment to everybody on all different levels because it did not produce the kind of water that the Bureau had hoped. And the Coast Basin Project is a closed basin in the San Luis Valley. And the idea of the project was to pump water out of that aquifer and put it into the Rio Grande to help Rio Grande flows. That obviously, as Rio says, it ended up depleting the aquifer and not helping the ground any, but it also did not produce as much water as was originally hoped. There are other groundwater type activities out there, Rio. I'm thinking on the Colorado River especially, but those are more directly connected to their rivers. So as far as I know, there's probably more out there, but the closed basin is pretty unique. I don't think I've seen in my career anything else close to that. Thanks for the question.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Would you say there's probably a project like that probably wouldn't be built these days?
Well, you know. You
never know, I guess.
You never know. Okay, anybody else? Well, I have to thank you all for your patience and appreciate you joining us. Next week, we'll have the Department of CDPHE, Health and Environmental Issues. Nicole Rowan will be here. I went through Waters of the United States and took a little bit of time on that because Nicole is going to talk about something that they started a conversation on this summer called States, Waters of the State. And the concern came with the Trump rule, as I said, reducing the scope And so they were worried that there were waters in Colorado that weren't going to be protected by that reduced scope. So they started a conversation, and there was actually a bill in the legislature that didn't go through. It got pulled. But the conversation's still going, and she's going to be talking about that. So looking forward to next week. Thank you all so much for your time and attention, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Hey, Jennifer, I just wanted to grab you at the end. I know Natalie had a question after the seminar ended, if you wanted to stick around for that. And then Nancy also just wanted to touch base with you after that. Great.
How many people did we have?
We had, let me, Molly, did you catch the highest number? It was somewhere in the 30s, right? Molly says 35.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And we got a bunch of thank yous in the chat. Oh, Tony said 33.
That's great. Yeah, we, Natalie, we debated with 5 students whether or not to move forward with this class. We thought that it might be under Zoom. It was an opportunity to reach out farther and beyond the limits that we had of meeting in Fort Collins. And so this has been an experiment for us that has ended up being a good one. Let's hold off. There's still a couple of people.
Yeah.
Maybe they walked away from their computers.
I think there's a chance I can remove them, but I don't know if that's like what you want me to do.
Go ahead and remove them.
Okay.
This is a cool class, though. I was just looking for a few more credits to take, and I was like, oh, this seems like a good thing to participate in. So
I'll tell you what, it's been a really fun class for me. And it's just last year I walked through all the interstate issues and international issues, and I felt like I was walking through my career. It was lots of fun.
Okay, everyone that except the COWC employees.
Okay. All right, Natalie. Okay.
Cool. So I'm TAing for a class called Sustainable Watersheds at CSU. It's in the Watershed Department. It's a 300 level. Basically, it's kind of a survey of watershed topics and like related. And at the end of the semester, we're hoping to have a couple lectures that talk about environmental justice and human rights and relationships with like indigenous people in Colorado to water. And so we are looking to